They lapsed into silence. The room muttered and wept around them, the voices of dozens of other conversations that rose and fell with no clear logic or pattern. Someone near the center of the room started shouting, and Daffod felt his back tensing like it was expecting a blow. But the anger faded away without sounds of violence. Sometime later, Cynia emerged from among the others. Her lips were thin and tight. She sat with her side to them, and when Jessen shifted, silently offering her a place in the circle, she didn't react. Anger radiated from her like cold from ice. Else arrived later, standing between Jessen and Kumpar and stretching like she was getting ready to exercise, until she only sat back on the floor, her feet tucked under her to keep her thighs from touching the chilly metal floor. Daffod caught her eye and lifted his chin in unspecific query. Else shook her head once. Whatever the conversation with Ostencor had brought, it wasn't something she wanted to talk about. He hoped it had been enough. At the other end of the cell, the spill of white light across the ceiling that came and went. Cynia tensed, but didn't move. "It's all right," El said. "It's going to be fine." Then a voice barked something Daffod couldn't make out, and Cynia jumped up and pushed through the crowd, heading for the light. Daffod followed her, not sure what he meant to do if he caught her. The bodies of his fellow captives blocked his way, shoving him as he tried to get by. Voices rose in a roar of alarm and confusion. Something screamed, and he didn't think it was human. The crowd grew denser, arms and chests pressing together until Daffod felt like he was being crushed. He'd heard stories like that, people trapped in groups so tight they could lift their feet off the ground and not fall. People who fell and died there. It would be a stupid way to go, but executed in reprisal for a doomed prison break was bad too. He turned his torso to the side, led with an elbow, pushed through people that a year ago he'd have been intimidated to speak with. The crowd had an edge like the wall of a hurricane's eye. Daffod broke through, stumbling out into the ad hoc pit where the violence was already happening. One of the soft Lothark was on the floor beside the sewage-stinking mat, pinned by six people kneeling on its long, thrashing limbs. Uris Ostencor straddled the thing's chest and punched down. The knife in his hand had probably been a support from someone's boot. It had pale blood on it now. Cynia was on one of the thing's arms, her teeth bared in animal rage. Daffod felt himself shouting, "Stop it," but he couldn't hear the words. The alien shrieked, a high, tight sound like a machine failing, and the people screamed their rage and bloodlust. Daffod stumbled. The alien thing tensed into stillness. Its shriek seemed to widen, like the sound was coming from its whole body, not just its mouth. Daffod was close enough to see the thin arms and stubby body pulse once, like it was a balloon someone had pushed a breath into. Ostencor's face shifted from rage to alarm, and the alien erupted. Its flesh expanded, popped, and spewed whitish liquid up and out. Daffod felt a warm, wet splash of it land on his arm. Cynia and the rest of the attackers were coated with it. It smelled like acid and overheated iron. The crowd went silent, except for one of the attackers saying, "What the hell was that?" Someone gagged. Ostencor stood, shaking his head slowly from side to side like a punch-drunk boxer. He started to say something, but stopped. His eyes went wide and he stumbled. Cynia screamed, clawing at her mouth. A few seconds later, more of them started screaming with her. Daffod's eyes stung enough that they watered. It was hard to see where he was or who was around him. The spot on his arm felt like it was heating up, like he was starting to burn. He pulled off what was left of his shirt, wiping desperately at the pale goo that clung to his skin. A wave of nausea bent him double. The crowd had pushed back, away from the caustic mess that had been their jailer. Daffod rose, took two slow, unsteady steps, and dropped to his knees again. The chamber seemed to be rising and falling like a ship in heavy waves. Austincourt was leaning against the door, his shiv forgotten at his feet. The others, Cynia included, were writhing and wailing, trying to crawl away from the mess that had been alive minutes before. Daffod turned his back to it, started to crawl, but the nausea came again, more powerfully, and he lost himself in it. He knew he was vomiting, but the event itself seemed distant. He heard voices, but he didn't know what they were saying. A spill of light brought him back to himself. He was splayed out on the floor, his cheek against the bare cold of the metal. He didn't remember how he'd gotten there, but not much time seemed to have passed. One of Austincourt's people, not Cynia, was beside him, weeping and struggling to move. The smell of acid and iron overwhelmed everything. Two soft Lothark lumbered in, indistinguishable from the dead one, their long limbs and compact bodies silhouetted against the brightness until the door closed behind them. Daffod thought, they're going to kill us. He was wrong. Instead, they looked around the floor like investigators at a crime scene, then lowered themselves to all fours and began slowly, methodically, eating the corpse. Daffod pulled himself up to sitting. The hold spun, and he had to press his palms into the floor to keep from falling back over. As he watched, the two aliens licked the floor with wide, dark tongues or tentacles, lifting bits of their fallen companion into wide slits of mouths. A memory of something horrible flickered and vanished. The human prisoners were pressed back away from the nightmare scene. An older man with a bald patch on the back of his head and a wide belly was dragging Cynia away, and Daffod felt a faint echo of relief. She wasn't dead. When the last of the corpse had been consumed, the aliens turned to the mat, rolling the shit-covered foam up like a carpet, then carrying it back to the door. The light came and went. A transporting sense of illness pressed Daffod back down against the floor. He was aware of a soft Lothark, a third one, or else one of the earlier pair, unrolling a fresh mat. Someone put a hand on his shoulder. He didn't want them to touch him. They were going to kill him. He wanted them to do it soon. After that, his consciousness came apart. He stopped being Daffod Alcor and fell into free-floating experiences of misery and fear, suffering and nausea, nightmare images and physical distress, and the constant dissolving heat of fever. Time became a permanent now, with no past to bring him here and no future before him. Now went on for a very long time. The first coherent thought was that the water had gone into his lungs. He coughed and rolled to his side, and by doing that remembered that he could cough, that he could move his body. The light was the same dull orange. He felt heavy and weak, like someone had turned up the gravity. When he rolled back, Else was there, sitting beside him with a wet cloth in her hand. She looked down at him like he'd done something stupid and brave, exasperation and affection mixed. "Hey there," he said. "You're back." I... He tried, then took a breath. I think so. Where was I? Poisoned, she said. By the... He waved a hand. Kampar and Jessen have been debating since it happened. Jessen thinks it's a defense mechanism, like a butterfly making predators sick. No help for the one that gets eaten, except that the predator won't go after its children or siblings. Inclusive fitness. Kampar says the aliens aren't brightly colored enough for that to be true, but he's probably just being obstinate, so they'll have something to talk about. He tried to sit up, and after a moment managed it. They were in the span of wall used for the infirmary. Four others were stretched out beside him. His shirt was gone, and his pants had been replaced with what looked like someone's old nightgown laid over him like a blanket. Else saw his confusion and smiled. She was beautiful when she smiled. She was always beautiful. It's been a while, she said. A while? A few days, as far as we can tell. Hygiene got to be tricky, and this seemed like the best solve. She held up the damp rag in her hand. We've been taking shifts to keep you hydrated and clean. Clean-ish. I'm sorry. It wasn't just me, or just us. Everyone's trying to help. Everyone was cleaning me up and dripping water in my mouth until my pants were too disgusting to leave on me. Doesn't actually make it better. She pushed a lock of greasy hair away from his eyes. Her fingertips felt warm. I think we're past shame here. Vague embarrassment? Fine, if it's important to you. Her smile faltered. We were worried. We've lost a couple. Reprisals? No, she said, crossing her legs and resting her elbows on her thighs. One of Sinia's friends reacted worse than the rest. He stopped breathing. Another one seemed like she was getting better, but she also had a heart condition and no medication since we left home. Austincourt had the worst exposure, and his fever broke yesterday. He's been sulking and keeping to himself. I don't think we need to worry about a second attempt. Not now, anyway. Sinia? Took a heavier dose than you and recovered sooner. I don't think she's doing well in other ways, though. I don't see how she... I don't know. Otherwise, nothing changed. They come and clean things away. The food is food. The water is water. Nothing changes here. It just goes on. Like we'll be here forever. Daffod pointed to the cloth and Else handed it to him. It was cool against his lips, and when he sucked the little bit of water out of it, he realized how thirsty he was. The idea of walking the few steps to the water trough seemed like a trek across a desert, though. He'd do it, but later. I keep waiting for the punishment to come, Else said. And then, you're shivering. I'm mostly naked, and I've been sick. She shifted up against him. Her body was warm. He rested his head against her shoulder and hoped his body was exhausted enough that it wouldn't react to her. For a long time, they didn't speak. Else ran her hand along his back like she could warm him by simple friction. When he closed his eyes, he felt exhaustion pulling him down. After a while, the shivering stopped. Thank you, he said. For what? Being here. Thank you for... You mean something, you know? To me. Shh, she said. Her palm caressed his arm, the sound of skin against skin. Let's talk about that later. You should rest. I was wrong, he said. About what? What they'd do. How they would act. What they are. I was lying there and watching them eat their dead. I remembered something, but I didn't know what. Do you now? He nodded against her. Her hand shifted to his back, moving more slowly. "One of my junior tutorials was biological systems," he said. "The tutor sacrificed a water beetle at the end of the term. She had named it Little Dot at the beginning of that term. Little Dot was a fixture in the class for weeks. We fed it sometimes." "She named a beetle?" "For a reason. She put the image on all our screens and then cut its abdomen open with a razor. Everything just spilled out. I remember someone actually started crying. It was Little Dot, after all. And then the beetle started eating its own spilled fat bodies." David rested for a moment, exhausted by the memory and the effort of speaking. Else's voice was disapproving. "I don't remember sadism being in the curriculum." "Her point was that we were all anthropomorphizing the insect, thinking that it was like us, thinking that when it was dying, it was afraid. But it was just a network of reflexes. When it noticed a high-energy food source, it ate. We knew what was happening, and we were horrified. Maybe Little Dot was more conscious than a clockwork toy. Maybe it wasn't. Either way, it did things a human being would never do, because it wasn't one." Her chin shifted, rested on the back of his head. "Vivid." He wanted to put his arms around her, be closer to the warmth of her body. It was too much effort. "It was a warning. I put myself in the other person's place. It's what I do. Your pathological move. My pathological move." He heard his words starting to slur, but he wasn't willing to surrender to sleep. Not yet. "I think, what would I do if I were them? Or, if I was doing what they did, why would I be doing it? It works more often than it doesn't. I thought there would be punishment because I thought they were like us. But there wasn't any. And I don't know why." "Yes, you do. You just said it. Because they aren't like us. They aren't like beetles either. But they aren't like us. I don't understand how they think. And that's terrifying." Else shifted, and he was afraid she was leaving. But she only kissed his forehead and settled back against him. It made his heart ache a little. "Rest now," she said. "We'll figure it out." Cynia lay on her side. Every now and then she turned. It was as close to catatonia as Jessen had seen without quite being motionless. When Jessen brought handfuls of the nutritional muck, Cynia swallowed them. When she brought wet rags, Cynia was willing to suck the damp out of the cloth. Now and then, Jessen escorted the older woman to the public mat, and then back again when she was done. It was excruciating. Kampar took turns sitting with her too, which Jessen appreciated, even though there was really nothing to do with her break from nursing Cynia. The hours before were like the hours after. The light never changed. The temperature never changed. The subtle hum of the ship remained eternally constant until her brain discounted it, and it became its own kind of silence. Kampar was sleeping when Jessen made another trip to the water trough, cloth in hand, and found Uris Ostenkor waiting for her. The soft Lothark's poison had taken a toll on him, or else the internment, or both, or everything. His cheeks and eyes were sunken. Jessen imagined that his skin was the color of ash, but in this light, who could tell? He pushed himself up to standing when she got close, and when he spoke, his voice was rough and phlegmy. "How is she?" Not great, Jessen said. Not dead, either, so I don't know.
I'd like to talk with her. You're her friends. If you're angry with me, I understand, but I'd like to talk with her.
He raised his chin, and Jessen imagined what he'd look like as a child on the school playground, performing bravery. Part of her wanted to tell him to stop posturing and go sit down, but most of her was too tired to care. She got the water, headed back to Sinia and Kampar, and let Austincourt follow her. When they reached the corner, Austincourt motioned to Jessen for the little water sop. She handed it to him, and he crouched down at Sinia's side.
"Hey there, soldier," he said.
He had a voice like warm flannel when he wanted it. Sinia's eyes focused on him. He held out the fabric, and the older woman heaved a sigh, sat up, and took what she'd been offered.
"How are you holding up?" Austincourt asked.
"I'm sorry. I am so sorry." "No, no, no. Don't be. You didn't do anything wrong. This was my mistake. But we learned from it. We know more now. We lived to fight another day."
"Some of you," Jessen thought, but didn't say. It didn't seem like the moment to be acid.
I thought even if we didn't, it would at least be over," Sinia said. "I thought it would be over."
"It isn't over," Austincourt said.
"And I know right now it doesn't feel like that's a good thing.
But it is. Listen to me, soldier. We're not defeated. This isn't over."
The way he said it, Jessen even believed it a little herself.
Chapter 12. The end came, with as little warning as the beginning. Daffid's strength returned slowly. He was able to walk from the little infirmary to the food and water, to take his turn on the mat without anyone there to keep him from falling. The nightgown blanket was torn, and its seams were beginning to loosen. He wore it wrapped around his waist like a towel. In the press of bodies and the degradations of time, he didn't stand out. Whatever the prisoners of Agian had worn when they were taken captive, they all wore rags now. The orange light never brightened and never dimmed. The grinding cold had become familiar. Always unpleasant, always to be managed, but known. Sinia slept the most, either with Jessen against her for heat or squatting with her eyes closed the way Kampar did. Daffod and Else sat together more often than they didn't. No one talked about the failed insurrection, but they didn't talk about much else either. There was nothing to say they hadn't said, and no one had any new experiences to relay. They were all living the same life, in different bodies. Someone in one of the other self-selected groups had begun a habit of singing, and over time a little choir had formed. Every now and then voices rose in religious hymns and dirges, or popular songs, or improvisations of harmony and cadence that ran on until they stopped. When it wasn't annoying, it was beautiful. Daffod was standing in the crowd listening to the falling notes of an old love song when the voice came, the calm, androgynous, perfectly enunciated voice of the apocalypse. "We will return to symmetrical space. The transition will not be harmful." For a moment, Daffod didn't believe it had happened. After so long in silence, it seemed more likely that he was hallucinating than that the voice had actually spoken. The man standing beside him, older, bald, familiar without being known, looked around like someone had entered the room, and then put a hand up to press against the low, oppressive ceiling.
He'd heard it too. Daffod's gut dropped. "Excuse me," Daffod said, as if they'd been having a conversation, and turned toward the corner of the chamber he thought of as theirs. A muttering of voices was rising like a wind in trees. He had the sudden, irrational feeling that if he didn't find the others before the thing happened, he'd never find them at all. The inversion of time was just as eerie, just as inexplicable, but more familiar. He remembered pressing past a young woman with wide, dark eyes and seeing Kampar with his arm around Sinia a moment before it happened. He knew Else would be to Kampar's left and Jessen to his right. He remembered the relief just before he actually felt it. By the time he saw Sinia's expression, mouth pulled back in horror and fear, and felt his own comfort evaporate, the effect had passed. "What's happening?" Sinia said, then repeated the phrase again and again and again, like she was caught in a loop. "It's all right," Jessen said. "We're all together. It'll be all right." It was a better answer than, "I don't know." A deep grinding reverberated, loud enough that Daffod felt it in the soles of his feet. The room shifted, shuddered, and grew lighter like an elevator falling too fast. The prisoners let out a collective gasp. Sinia closed her eyes, her fists pressed against her legs.
"I didn't think I was going to miss this place," Kampar said. "I'm suddenly less certain of that."
Whatever the maneuvers their captors were making, they seemed to go on forever. And then, when the hold shuddered, stilled, and went silent, it was all over too quickly. The doors opened, white light spilling through the orange. Daffod took Else's hand with his left, Kampar's with his right. The voice came from everywhere. "You will move out to the platform. Your identities will be confirmed. Exit now." A live breeze whipped through the stillness of the prison, reaching back as far as Daffod. Its biting cold made the constant grating chill of the cell seem warm. Gooseflesh rose on his arms and legs, but Daffod hadn't realized how much he missed the sensation of moving air until he felt the cool breeze caress his face. Jessen put her arm across Sinia's shoulders. Kampar, his face suddenly capable of a color besides dull, purgatorial orange, was ashen. For a long moment, nothing moved. And then a soft hushing sound came from the doorway, the soles of feet hissing against the deck. Like dazed animals at a slaughterhouse, they shambled forward toward the light and cold. A new world opened. Daffod had expected to see one of the city-huge ships that had come to Ajian, but the prison cell must have been detached at some point. It sat like a low, squat warehouse, alone on a plain of green-brown metal, like the flattened summit of a great mesa, etched with complex lines of steel and silver. Past the edge, huge ebony ziggurats rose, one after another, after another. Any one of them was large as a mountain, with long bars of light that gleamed from their summits down to the clouds that hid their bases. Where the pale clouds grew thin, Daffod caught glimpses of smaller structures, forests or buildings or both, that glimmered with red and golden light. A world city. Above them, vast silver arches rose up toward the white disk of the sun. They were too huge to be buildings, too elegant to be natural structures. They reached up toward space with the casual ease of a stairway rising to a balcony. In the high air, areas of brightness shifted and spun. He couldn't tell if they were structures or tricks of reflection and diffraction, but they seemed to flow like glowing thread, floating or moving or rising to the hidden stars. And above them, almost too faint to make out, spots of darkness. A grid of tiny black dots like the ones that had come to humble Ajin. On the etched plain, six of the Karraks stood. Three had shells or armor or uniforms, the same green and gold as the invading force on Ajin. The fourth was easily half again as large, and bone white. It was flanked by two more in armor of dull red, and their massive front arms were nearly twice the size of the others. They stood closest to the white one in the center. All six radiated the same air of magisterial calm and power. The long-limbed, squat-bodied, soft Lothark loped through the crowd of gawking humanity, tugging here and there at one person and then another, encouraging them forward. The air smelled like distant rain, like fog. It smelled clean. One of the soft Lothark led a group of people Daffod didn't know past the massive white Karraks. When they stood staring up at it in confusion, the soft Lothark kicked one of them behind the knee and pushed him down to the platform, arms spread. All but one of the others quickly followed suit. The one person still on her feet shouted up at the big white Karraks, though she was too far away for Daffod to hear what she was saying. She stood shaking her fist in rage for a moment, and then exploded into a spray of tissue and pink mist that splattered across the platform floor. It happened so fast that it took Daffod a moment to realize that one of the two red-armored monsters had lashed out with its arm. It placed the now bloody end of that limb back on the ground and waited. The remaining people in the group stayed on their bellies until they were prodded back to their feet and led away. One of the other soft Lothark tapped at Daffod's arm, shifting its attention from him to Else and back as fast as a twitch. A voice came from the small, dark square at its chest. "Daffod Alcor and Else Yanin, you come this way now." It plucked at Else's arm, then his, urging them forward, tugging him out of Kampar's grasp. Still hand in hand, they followed. The bone-pale Karraks shifted to watch them, and they were made to stop before it. Daffod didn't wait for the soft Lothark's kick. He dropped onto his face, pulling Else down with him, and remained very still. He had the sudden, sharp memory of an image from divination cards he'd played with as a child. A man and woman in chains before a huge and terrible beast. One of the green and gold Karraks trilled and whistled like a pipe organ imitating a bird. It gestured at them with its thin feeding arms. The pale beast made a single, fluting reply, and the soft Lothark dragged them back to their feet and away, while another jailer hauled another group of debased prisoners to stand where they had been. "I think we were just presented to the king," Daffod said. "Spoils of war." "Maybe," Else said, and she was right. Whatever it looked like, it might be something else. The soft Lothark seemed to consult with the lines on the ground, reading some meaning in them that Daffod couldn't fathom. It opened its mouth, and the black tongue slapped wetly against its cheek. "Here," the voice said from his chest. "You will wait here for the transport to come. Do not leave this place." Before Daffod could decide whether he was supposed to tell it that he understood, it slid away. Else was squinting up at the strange towers in the distance. Her hair was greasy, the color of tarnished copper, and sticking to her scalp and neck like it had been pasted there. There were bags under her bloodshot eyes. He followed her gaze. The vast silver arches, the hypnotic shimmering lights, the dark grid against the sky. In the distance, a huge platform rose up the side of one of the ziggurats, moving as smoothly as a key turning in a lock. It was breathtaking.
"We never had a chance," he said. "Look at all this. We never stood a chance against this."
"We did not," Else agreed. "Too bad we didn't know.
Knowing wouldn't have mattered."
She looked over at him. There were lines at the sides of her mouth that hadn't been there before the invasion. She'd grown thin enough that her cheekbones were sharp, and there was a little indentation behind her chin where the cushion of fat had been burned away by hunger and stress. They all looked like that, standing humiliated and half-naked on the alien platform. Thin, wasted, broken. Daffid gestured to them, the captives of Ajian.
"We'd have fought anyway," he said,
thinking of Austin Kaur and his improvised knife, Sinia wrestling down the guard.
"It's what we do."
"I don't know if that idea is stupid or noble," El said.
"Human," Daffid said. "It's just human. We don't stop just because there's no hope."
Else nodded, stopped with her brow furrowed. A tear dropped from her eye unnoticed, and she shrugged.
"There's always hope for something.
Just not always what we want." Jessen lay on the bed and tried to decide whether she felt nauseated. The rooms they'd been taken to were the architectural equivalent of an unmastered second language. The parts were mostly there, bedrooms, a common area, a kitchen, but it was all a little wrong. The doors were functional, but too wide, and the panels that opened them were placed high and off-center. The clothing, shirts, pants, underwear, that waited for them was all rolled into cylinders and held in place with something like wax that shattered when they were unrolled. The cloth felt like soft canvas and smelled like mint. She didn't have any idea what the fibers actually were. She had laid them out, but she hadn't taken off the rags and remnants she'd worn since the day she was captured, much less put on something clean. There were 10 bedrooms along a single corridor from a common area. The one she'd taken for herself was in the middle along the left side. It had a bed, a bedside table, too low to be useful, shelves with more waxy rolls of clothing, a chair and a desk with nothing to write with or on, and a shower in the corner. Dull metallic tiles and a step down into a drainage pan. There was no curtain or door to keep water from splashing across the rough metal floor. It was like someone had seen that people liked privacy to sleep and to shower and decided the two must go together. The toilet, and thank all that was holy there was a functional toilet and not more of those repulsive mats, was communal, but with its own little closet. She knew that she should bathe. She wanted to. She would soon, just not yet. The mattress was soft. The blanket was some kind of artificial fleece, scratchy but warm. When she closed her eyes, she felt the press of strangers and misery. But now, when she opened them, she was alone. The air smelled like fennel instead of shit and formaldehyde. She had a little window that looked out into the white sky and the sun above it, even if the sun was behind 100 little dots. If she stood next to the window, she could see a half dozen of the dark ziggurats and part of the curve of the arches that rose up past the sky. The ceiling was too high for her to reach, and the light was white. There were colors. After her duration in orange purgatory, she was grateful for colors, and she was angry that she was grateful. She was overwhelmed by the quiet. The privacy ached like a reperfusion injury. Voices came from the common area. Else's low tones, The way she always ended her sentences with a downturn, like she was making a statement, even when she was asking a question. Kampar's habitual sly deadpan, the same when he was joking and being serious. Jessen curled over, grabbed the pillow and pulled it over her ears to block them out. Little waves of illness kept washing through her, and fits of trembling so subtle she wasn't sure if it was her body or a low vibration shaking the whole room. She tried to imagine Jellet on a bed like this, somewhere maybe even nearby. The combination of hope and despair ached more than either feeling alone would have. When she'd been younger, one of her physicians had warned her against comparing her distress to other people's. No matter what conclusion you drew, he said, you'd made a mistake. Either you saw someone else suffering, like Cynia, staggering under the grief of Noel's execution, and decided that your own pain didn't matter. Or you saw someone laboring under what seemed like a minor problem, Daffid mooning after Else, and Else letting him, and discounted their troubles as trivial. The first case was an excuse for self-negation. The second invited contempt. Jessen felt herself doing both now, while the small, sane part of her watched powerless. Kampar's laugh pushed through the pillow. Jessen wished both that he would shut up and that she was out there with the others. She rolled onto her back again, letting the pillow fall away. You are a fucking mess, she said aloud to herself. You're always a fucking mess. It never stopped you before. Some part of her mind replied. She clenched her jaw, stood up, and started stripping off the filthy clothes she'd worn since the night she'd been captured. The shower controls seemed to consist of a single button. When she pressed it, the nozzle hit her with a blast of red liquid that smelled like industrial cleanser. Jessen screamed and was just about to leap out of the shower when the nozzle switched and began spraying clean, warm water. There was no soap, but whatever the red goo was, it loosened up the layer of filth caked on her. The top layers of her skin peeled off as she rubbed, like she'd been sunburned and was only now healing. She washed her hair, scrubbed her flesh, dug a black gel of filth out from under her two long fingernails. There was a little box set into the wall with a razor, toothbrush, and a comb, and, for reasons she couldn't fathom, a small steel spoon. Finding them was like discovering buried treasure. When she felt clean, she turned off the water, stepped out into her room. Now that she was clean, it was hard to even touch her old clothes, but she had to. She rooted around in the pockets until she found the little bottle of pills. There were still enough to rattle. She dressed in the alien clothes, then counted out the pills, putting them in a line on her bed. 16. So, either they had been in the hold of the alien ship for about 6 weeks, and she'd been taking her medication as she should, or less than that if she'd had too much, or more if she'd been too sparing. But 6 weeks seemed about right. 6 weeks, and a lifetime. One by one, she put the pills back in their bottle, then hid the bottle under her mattress. She didn't think anyone was really going to steal them, but they were precious, and the instinct to protect them was both powerful and harmless. Focus, she said. Just focus. Let go of all the things you can't control and find the things you can. It almost sounded like a joke, a punchline. What could she control? How could she control anything? Usually, that was the voice of her depression. Here, it was just being realistic. Time to be unrealistic, then, Jellet said in her imagination, and she actually managed a grim little smile. In the common room, Kumpar said, "Oh my God," and adrenaline rushed into Jessen's blood. Irina answered. Jessen was out of the door of her room before the other woman's words had faded. The common area was a main room with a scattering of institutional chairs and couches in front of a massive window, like the lobby at a decent transport hub, an open kitchen and dining area. Irina stood by the too wide doorway from the corridor that their alien captors had ushered them through. Her skin had gone so pale that she was nearly the same white as her hair, as though she'd been dipped in bleach. Her body was thinned to the edge of emaciation. She wore a ragged skirt that had begun its life as a man's sweatshirt and a dark jacket that was slick and shining with filth. Jessen crossed the common room and threw her arms around the thin woman. Irina hugged her back fiercely, and then they were both crying.
"You made it," Jessen said. "You're all right. You made it."
"You did too," the younger woman said. They broke off the embrace, Jessen grinning through tears, and Kumpar swooped in, picking Irina up in a bear hug of his own. "Please," Irina said, her words bubbling through a half-sane laughter of release and relief. "I'm disgusting."
"You are made of gold and sunshine, and you smell like fresh roses," Kumpar said. "And the same for you, old man."
"It's good to see you too," Tanner Fry said.
He was in the kitchen area. He'd lost so much weight that the face hiding behind his thick, dark beard looked like someone else. There was a bruise that covered half his neck, old enough that it was turning green and yellow as it healed. But his hair was the same rising, unruly gray, and his voice was familiar. He had his arm around Else's waist. Her smile was wide, showing more of her teeth than Jessen remembered ever seeing at once before. And beside them, Dafydd Alcor stood with a blank, stunned smile, like someone had hit him with a brick, and he was trying to be happy about it. Jessen remembered all the days when Else and Dafydd lay beside each other in the darkness. All the time the second lead of the research team had tended to the sickness of the research assistant. The gentleness between them, and the need. And now here Tanner was, like waking up out of a dream. How strange that anything from before could still matter.
"You poor fuckers, all of you," Jessen thought, but she didn't say it.
"They have some use for us," Tanner said, pulling on a clean shirt for the first time in weeks and running his hand over his freshly shaved chin. It felt wonderful. He hated having a beard.
"They must."
"Yes." Else sat on the bed, her back against the headboard and her arms wrapped around her knees. Her face was too thin, and her hair had grown out. The way it framed her cheeks seemed wrong, as if the mental image he'd held of her through the long, terrible weeks had suddenly jumped. She was quiet and still, thinking through what he'd said, and then lifted an eyebrow the way she always had, and she seemed more like herself again.
"Well, I don't think it's physical labor. If it is, their target selection's terrible."
Tanner felt a little sting. He liked to think of himself as a man who could build a wall or dig a ditch if the occasion called for it, and the implication that he wasn't annoyed him. But then he also knew himself well enough to hold back any quarrels until he'd rested and slept. He was never able to tell directly when he was stressed. He had to watch himself like he was the subject of an experiment and judge from outside. He thought he felt perfectly normal, but irritability was a frequent sign of being in distress. Judging from Else's report, her own journey from Ajian had been much like his and Irina's. The dark, cold, low room, packed with bodies, the alien keepers, though his group hadn't assaulted one. The misery, the death. Tanner and Irina had watched 7 people die before they had reached whatever the moieties of the Carrix were. Mostly, they'd been older men and women whose health had been imperfect before the invasion. Dair Feria, conductor of the Abbasat Symphony and popular educator on all things musical, had died at Tanner's feet. He'd grown up watching her documentaries for children. When he thought about her, he could still see the gape of her mouth as she struggled to breathe. That was interesting. Intrusive memories were another sign. Clearly he was overstressed. "They'd been monitoring us," Els said. "I think they must have been. They knew who we were by name. They chose people who were the top of their fields, including us. They have to want expertise, don't they?" And the language. There wasn't a pause to learn how best to translate. They knew how to speak to us and how to understand what we said back. "And now this," Els said, gesturing with her chin toward the bed, the window, the shower, and all the rooms beyond it. "Their best approximation of how humans live." "That red glop in the shower instead of soap, though," Tanner said with disapproval. "That was a miss." Els gave him a wan smile. "Our own little dormitory. So likely they aren't just looking to harvest our brains." He chuckled before he realized that she hadn't been joking. Fair enough. Extracting whatever knowledge the Carrix wanted through surgical means was as plausible as anything else they'd suffered. He sat on the edge of the bed and ran his hands through his still damp hair. "Well, it's not as wide as the bed back at home, but I suppose it'll do." Els started like a mouse and looked down at the mattress and blankets. Then, after a moment, "I don't think it will. I have my own room already. And anyway, I don't know that we should be demonstrative given the present situation. There are more than enough bedrooms for all of us." "That's ridiculous," he snapped. "If Noel had lived, everyone would expect that he and Sinia would share one." "He didn't, though. It doesn't apply." Tanner sighed, harsh and percussive. "You can't still be angry that I told you to take Alcor to get that stupid telescope. That was a lifetime ago." "It was. And no, I'm not angry." "What then? Because this is a strange time to be renegotiating how we sleep together. I would have thought you'd be happy to see me again." Els released her knees and stretched out her legs. She had a way of relaxing like a hunting cat, like a preparation for violence. "I've been through an unpleasant and traumatizing set of experiences," she said, each word clear and careful, "and I find the idea of having a space that's just my own very appealing. Are you telling me I'm not permitted to do that?" "Yes," floated at the back of his tongue, like the idea of jumping that came with looking down a cliff, a suicidal tingle. He shook his head. "I'm not at my best either." She rubbed an open palm on his shoulder like she was comforting a sick child. It was a little condescending, but part of him appreciated it anyway. "I am sorry Noel died," he said. "Sinia is going to be a problem," Els replied with a nod, as if that was what he actually meant. He was still considering his reply to that when a sound came from outside the room, the clack and hiss of the main door rolling open. Someone barked out a cry of alarm. Tanner felt the fear in his chest and neck, raw and immediate, as if it had been waiting for the chance to attack. They exchanged a look and headed for the door. He walked down the little corridor toward the common area with his hands clasped behind his back to keep them from shaking. The two newcomers couldn't have been more different. The human one was the thin remnant of Ricker Damatan. The ragged scraps of cloth that hung from his shoulders were recognizable as one of his jackets. His feet were bare, and the patchy beard that he'd grown in the weeks aboard the alien ship looked moth-eaten and sickly. A long, black scab marked the side of his face, and his eyes were locked on the middle distance. Beside him, the alien seemed huge, though it was smaller than the others of its species that Tonner had seen. The green and gold shells were gone. They'd been armor, or clothing, or the mark of a different gender or clade. This Carex had the same form, though. A back section with four legs, and a broad, flat abdomen like an insect, an upright thorax and head supported by two much larger legs, and then two mantis-like forearms at the front. This one had flesh that was somewhere between purple and beige, and two pairs of black eyes large enough to almost look childlike. Below the eyes was a small, thick beak in the center of a mass of muscular folds that Tonner assumed was its face. It shifted on its back four legs like a dog dancing with excitement. The two heavy forearms were planted on the floor, immovable as granite pillars. It gave Tonner the eerie sense that the Carex was two different animals at once. Kampar, Daffod, and Jessen were all on their feet, all of them looking at the newcomers. Sinia sat by the window, looking out at the alien landscape as if she could ignore the Carex to death. The alien chittered, whistled, and a voice came from the black square that hung around its neck, not the voice they'd heard on Agian or the ships. This was low, vaguely masculine, and pleasantly reedy, like the alien was a particularly friendly clarinet. "I understand that one of your working group was lost. You have a tradition of offering sympathy on these occasions. I offer this sympathy. You are to feel comfortable." Sinia made a quiet, strangling noise. The alien paused like it was waiting for a translation that didn't come. Jessen stepped forward, and Kampar reached out unconsciously to pull her back to safety. "Where are we?" Jessen said. "What do you want with us?" The alien's back half capered a little faster for a moment, then calmed. Its massive forelegs bent a degree. "I am Tixon of the cohort Malkal, and I have been made keeper librarian of your moiety," it said, sang. "For the moieties, usefulness is survival. I am here to help you succeed and survive." Part 3. Puzzles. Your species is not the first we have encountered with the delusion that peace is a desirable state. The Ecclil of Hanabor spent half of their history composing scent symphonies in praise of a state free from tension and pain that none of them ever experienced. The Mitria Salo worshipped the point of equanimity in defiance of all evidence that such a thing was impossible. Your own people were in a constant generational argument over which group or subgroup, gender or culture or religion, suffered most at the hands of the others, as if the concept of justice were not narrative and abstract. Over and over again we found it in our subject species, this faith that a state of peace was not only possible, but desirable. That if only someone were clever enough, or wise enough, a way could be found for everyone to be in comfort and satiety. This delusion has never been the error of the Carex. We knew from the moment we knew anything that what can be subjugated must be. The species that exist long enough to achieve higher orders of intelligence do so only by relentlessly outcompeting the other species around them. And it is this endless, iterative testing of ourselves against the universe that drives us eternally toward greater power and effectiveness. Your people, like many of the subject species we've encountered, believe that there is a tipping point where the constant fight for supremacy becomes unethical, where peace becomes the new norm. As though it is possible, through intellect or philosophy, to transcend the fundamental nature of all life. The betrayer, though, that one managed both. He could dream of perfection without being fettered by it. He desired peace and destroyed countless worlds to take it. He held both these ideas in his mind at the same time, and instead of this dissonance ripping him apart, it made him powerful. If we had known that before it was too late, we would have killed him. You should take note of that. You would be wise to kill him too. From the final statement of Ekur Taklal, Keeper Librarian of the Human Moiety of the Carrix. Chapter 13. The librarian, if that's what it wanted to be called, led them at the pace of a brisk walk. Ricker was at the back of the group, several long steps behind. His face hurt where the wound was still healing. The remnants of the clothes he'd worn since Agian stuck to his skin. But they'd been doing it so long he hardly noticed anymore. Tanner and Else and the others were all in clean tunics and trousers of off-white and yellow, their faces washed and their hair brushed. Kampar had a little beard he hadn't had before, neatly trimmed and shaped. Jessen's hair was still wet from the shower. She and Irina held hands like schoolchildren on a field trip. Tanner and Else walked side by side, without touching, with Daffid close behind them. Kampar sped up and slowed down, checking in on each member of their little group over and over again, like a sheepdog herding his flock and keeping an eye out for wolves. It was the big man's look of disapproval that had encouraged Ricker to give the rest of the group a wide berth. Sinia didn't come with them, and no one seemed to question her absence. Noel wasn't there, and no one commented on that either. But Ricker had seen enough in the past weeks to guess. He was so happy to see them all, he wanted to cry. He was afraid of what would happen if he did. Or maybe he was just afraid. Fear had become the default setting of late. The hallways were as wide as streets, the walls of the same cool metallic roughness as the holding cell had been, but laced by lines and patterns and angled in so that the ceilings were always a little bit narrower than the floors. After a life spent in the gentle curves of Agian's grown coral buildings, the architecture of the Carrix felt aggressively manufactured, like they were moving through the interior of some vast machine. "You are all permitted access to this pathway," the librarian said, "and all